Beginning in verse 1 of chapter 5 of Genesis, we read, "This is the book of the genealogy of Adam. In the day that God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He created them male and female and blessed them and called them mankind in the day that they were created. And Adam lived 130 years and begat a son in his own likeness after his image and named him Seth. After he begot Seth, the days of Adam were 800 years and he had sons and daughters. So all the days that Adam lived were 930 years and he died." And I'm going to pick it up in the last verse of this chapter. "And Noah was 500 years old, and Noah begat Shem, Ham, and Japheth." And please be aware that chapter 5 is the lineage between Adam and getting us all the way to Noah. Picking up in verse 1 of 6. "Now it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, and that they were beautiful. And they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. And the Lord said, My spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh. Yet his days shall be 120 years. There were giants on the earth in those days, and also afterwards when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. They were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. And the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent and the thoughts of men were only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. So the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both men and beasts, creeping things and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. And this is the genealogy of Noah. And Noah was just a man, perfect in all his genealogies or generations. Noah walked with God, and Noah begot three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. The earth also was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. So God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way to the earth. And God said to Noah, The end of all the flesh has come before me. The earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth. Make yourself an ark of gopher wood. Make rooms in the ark, cover it inside and outside with pitch, and this is how you will make it. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, its width 50 cubits, and its height 30 cubits. And you shall make a window for the ark, and you shall finish it in to a cubit from above, and set the door of the ark in its side. You shall make it with lower, second, and third decks. And behold, I myself am bringing flood waters on earth to destroy from under the heaven all flesh for which is breath of life. Everything that is on the earth shall die. But I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall go into the ark, you and your sons and your wife and your sons' wives with you, and every living thing of all flesh you shall bring, two of every sort into the ark, to keep them alive with you, and they shall be male and female. Of the birds after the kind, of animals after the kind, of creeping things, of the earth after its kind, two of every kind will come to you to keep them alive, and you shall take them for yourself of all food that is eaten, and you shall gather it to yourselves, and it shall be food for you and for them. Thus Noah did according to all that God commanded him. So he did." Let's stand.
Morning, everybody. Good. Nice to have you with us this morning. We're going to be picking it up today in Genesis 5, continuing a study that we've been moving through on and off for a few months here. Just to bring everybody up to speed on where we are, so far we've seen the creation of man. We've seen creation of the world and everything around us. But then we saw that man in his own wisdom chose to disobey God and set things on a course for which the entire Bible is written for God to correct. And where we find ourselves today is kind of a step back, looking at the genealogy that came from Adam. You could call it the godly line, and how that follows down to bring us to the story of Noah, of which we're all familiar, at least in the children's variety, with all the animals peeking their heads out of the top of a small boat. But we're going to get into that story, and it's probably going to take us a few different Sunday mornings together to get through that. So in the future, we'll be continuing through the story of Noah. But the way this is going to go today is we're going to start off a little easy. We're going to get stuck in the mud a little bit on some difficult passages, and then we'll find our way back out as we get into the actual story of Noah. So we're going to pick it up, chapter 5, verse 1, if you're not there already. This is the book of the genealogy of Adam. In the day that God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He created them, male and female. He blessed them and called them mankind in the day they were created. And Adam lived 130 years, and he begot a son in his own likeness, after his image, and named him Seth. After he begot Seth, the days of Adam were 800 years, and he had sons and daughters. So all the days that Adam lived were 930 years, and he died. And this idea of death is going to be the refrain in this chapter. The idea of death and what brought about that death was Adam, again, in his wisdom, and Eve in her wisdom, disobeying the voice of God. Can you remember back in Genesis 2, God spoke this: of every tree of the garden you may freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you do eat of it, you shall surely die. And now we start to see that played out. And that's the thing about God's promises. What he says is always going to play out. We may think we get away with it for a little bit, but eventually, what he said is going to come true. And that's what we see beginning to play out in Genesis here. God, in what he said, his word, will always stand true. We think we can get away with things in our own wisdom, but what he says stands. It will stand. And we see that happening. Now he shows grace on Adam. He shows grace on Eve. He gives a way of salvation to these two, just like he will to Noah. But nonetheless, they're reaping the consequences of their disobedience to God. And generations after them, their sons, their daughters, all the way down to us. But we have this repeating phrase that so-and-so lived and so-and-so died. If you want to try to fight your way through all those difficult names in chapter 5, you're going to see that. You're going to catch the rhythm really quick. So-and-so lived, he begat so-and-so, and he died. He died. Let's skip down to verse 18. We see kind of a glitch in the system here. When Jared was 162 years old, he became the father of Enoch. After the birth of Enoch, Jared lived another 800 years, and he had other sons and daughters. Jared lived 962 years, then he died. When Enoch was 65 years old, he became the father of Methuselah. After the birth of Methuselah, Enoch lived in close fellowship with God, or your translation might say walked with God, for another 300 years. And he had other sons and daughters. Enoch lived 365 years, walking in close fellowship with God. Then one day he disappeared. God took him. So this is a break in the system. This is a break in the rhythm of Genesis 5. We see people living, having children, and dying. Until we get to Enoch, we see him not dying, but God taking him. God took him. Miraculously took him. In what form or format, we don't have the details. But nonetheless, God did not let him die. And the only unique thing that we know about Enoch is this, that he walked with God, that he stood out as being one who is in close fellowship with God. Did these other individuals have close fellowship with God? Well, we don't know the details. We could presume there was some acknowledgement of God in their life. We saw at the end of chapter 4 that said at this point in time, people began to call on God. They began to worship him. But for whatever reason, this individual, Enoch, stands out as somebody who walked in close fellowship with God. It reminds us of Adam and Eve in the garden, right? Walking with God in the cool of the day. This appears to be how things were supposed to be. That mankind would walk in close fellowship with God. That we would have tight fellowship. That when God whispers, we can hear him. That when God takes a left, we are close enough to see that he takes a left, and we do so ourselves. We walk in close fellowship. There's a form of relationship with God that is not close at all. Perhaps you couldn't even call it fellowship. Perhaps it's strange to call it a relationship. But this is beyond just knowing of God and worshiping him from afar. This is walking with him as Jesus' disciples walked with Jesus, right? This is a relationship that is offered to us throughout the Bible, especially the New Testament, in the times that we live, the opportunity to walk closely with God. And apparently this individual did that. Enoch did that. So he didn't die like the rest. God took him. It appears that his walk was so close with God that he walked his way right into heaven. So the New Testament gives us a little more insight on this individual. Here just to do a little study. In Jude 14 to 15, there's no chapters. It says this, Enoch, who lived in the seventh generation after Adam, prophesied about these people. Prophesying about the world around him. And here's what Enoch said. This is a quotation of Enoch. Listen, the Lord is coming with countless thousands of his holy ones to execute judgment on the people of the world. He will convict every person of all the ungodly things they have done and for all the insults that ungodly sinners have spoken against him. So this guy is a fiery individual. Prophesying like this about, he's prophesying about the second coming of Christ at this point. So lest we think that this walk with God is always kind of this, boy, like this hippie existence of just flowing with God. Listen, the only thing we know about what Enoch said, it's pretty intense. This guy was a preacher and he stood up for who God was and what it meant to follow God. And apparently he was known as being pretty rabid guy. So I guess that comes along with walking with God, at least at that point in time. It seems like God will never leave a generation without a preacher, including that one. And we're going to see the same thing with Noah. He's a preacher. He prophesied. He preached. God does not leave the world without a witness, whether it's his word or an individual, whether it's spoken from a pulpit like this, or whether it's spoken at a conversation at the break room at work. God doesn't leave any generation without a witness, without a way of getting his word in truth to them. And therefore, nobody can have an excuse, ultimately. And at this point in time, God did not leave the world with an excuse to disobey. There was a preacher. I find it interesting with Enoch also, that if you look at how long these individuals lived, 700, 800, 900 years old, he's a bit of an anomaly. You know, God took him. He didn't die a natural death, but he only lived to 300. And if you kind of just do some rough math, if people are living 900 years old, and this guy lived at 300, analogously, that'd be maybe dying in your late 20s, 30s, 40s today. He had a short life. He had a short life, and I wonder how we would look at that. This individual lived a short time on earth. He was taken early, we might say, by God. Yet he walked with God. I wonder what we would prefer. I wonder how his father, Jared, felt about that. His father outlived him. And we know that's we would consider that a tragedy. For parents outlive their child. But nonetheless, he did. By hundreds of years. Outlived his child. I wonder how Jared felt about that. Would he rather have had his son around? Or would he rather have had his son walk with God? Interesting to think about. Certainly could translate to us. Would we rather have our children around? Would we rather have them be part of things? Or would we rather that they walk with God? And maybe they aren't here for everything. Maybe they're even taken early, at least in our minds. Well, moving on, Methuselah, just real briefly on him. Oftentimes he works his way into Bible trivia as being what? As far as we know, the person who lived the longest, certainly recorded in the Bible. He lived 969 years. Interestingly, on this guy, I don't have much to elaborate on, but he died in the year that the flood came. We presume that he didn't die in the flood because God didn't set up a plan to take him, even though it's part of this somewhat godly line. But nonetheless, he died in the year of the flood. And the only thing I can extract from that, and I don't want to go beyond scripture here, but it seems that God, in this genealogy, in this line, was even demonstrating his patience. His patience with mankind. He was warning, he was prophesying, he was trying to lead people around to come back to him. And the man that lived the longest here on earth, delayed the flood until his death. God is patient. God is patient. And while the highlight of this story oftentimes is the animals that make it through, the people that make it through, and the destruction, much of this story is about God's great patience. Patience with mankind. Wanting them to turn around. Wanting them to repent. Wanting them to correct the wrong and come back to him. Verse 28, moving on. When Lamech was 182 years old, he became the father of a son. Lamech named his son Noah, for he said, "May he bring us relief from our work in the painful labor of farming this ground that the Lord has cursed." And after the birth of Noah, Lamech lived another 595 years, and he had other sons and daughters. Lamech lived 777 years, then he died. After Noah was 500 years old, he became the father of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So Noah, there's a bit of prophecy when Noah was born by his father. Kind of this idea that Noah would somehow bring about relief or comfort from the toil that they spent in the ground. A little hard to interpret exactly what that means, other than Noah will bring some kind of relief, and he does. You know, we'll get to that end of the story. When Noah makes it through, he actually becomes a farmer. So there's some kind of connection between him and the ground that he's gonna dig into and plant. But post-flood, that's what we'll find out about Noah, is there's relief that's brought. We don't know what that's going to look like at this point in the story. Certainly his father wouldn't have had the details, but the hope was there. And I think that's the important point here, is that with the godly, there is always hope. Despite how difficult things are, we're gonna get into this. It's going to get a little muddy here shortly, trying to understand what the culture was like at this time. But with the godly, there's always hope. There is always hope. If you are God's child, if you are a follower, if you believe that his word is written out in the Bible for us to learn and obey, there is hope for you. No matter how bleak things are looking in this world, there is hope. And that is part of the story we're beginning to see here, is that there's hope for God's people. Those who would choose to put him first and separate themselves from the culture of the world, there's hope. And Lamech seemed to have that. And he wasn't just birthing a child and, well, we'll see what happens. We'll give it up. We'll try our best. No, there was hope and belief that God was going to come through. That God was going to have something for this child to do. That's hope. That's a reliance and trust in God, that he would do something. Now, I don't mean to get too nerdy here, but just a little step back. There's an interesting parallel between kind of Genesis 4, which would be Cain's line, and Genesis 5, which is Seth's line. You don't have to turn there or anything, but the last few people in Cain's line go like this. Methushael, I think I got that right, Lamech, and then he had sons. The godly line was Methuselah, Lamech, and then Noah. So comparing these two real quickly here, because it leads us into where we're going. Lamech's line on the Cain side, he gave birth to these individuals, Jabal, Jubal, and Tubal-Cain. If you remember, I believe Pastor Ben explained that these guys were the ones who introduced agricultural developments, music, flute, crafting, making metals, making weapons and tools, culture. World culture was produced by the people that came out of Cain's line, Lamech's sons. On the godly side, Lamech, the godly Lamech, his son brought about escaping that culture, escaping it. Not building the culture of the world, but escaping it. And it's an interesting parallel that the writer here, Moses, seems to set up between the two. Now, moving on, this is where we're going to get stuck in the mud a little bit, so hopefully I can put it in four wheel and we'll make it through. But chapter 6, probably generally agreed upon as being one of the more difficult sections of Scripture, certainly the Old Testament. But we'll see what we can do here. Chapter 6, verse 1, now it came to pass when men began to multiply in the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. And the Lord said, my spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh, and his days shall be 120 years. There were giants, or Nephilim, on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came in to the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. Those were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. So the question obviously is, what the heck's going on here? Who are these sons of God? Who are these giants? And I can't give you a conclusive answer, but we're going to look at two options. One I think is preferred by most, okay? I don't know how I got stuck with this passage anyway. We don't pick them. We just obey. So sons of God. First of all, sons of God throughout the New Testament, the Old Testament, typically refers to divine beings. Obviously, Jesus was called the only begotten Son of God. We can inherit sonship, daughtership, when we're adopted into God's family, right? We can become children of God. There's no mystery there. But typically, sons of God is used to describe divine beings, especially early on in the Old Testament. So one reference for you, Job 1:6. We all know the story of Job. Now, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. Very clearly speaking of kind of an angelic courtroom, if you will. And the sons of God are individuals in that, not humans. Okay? Not humans. So this is kind of the preferred take, that these sons of God are actually angelic, or you could say demonic in nature, whichever. And that the daughters of men are simply offspring, human offspring, and that what's happening here is the sons of God are stepping out of bounds, as it were, to engage in relations with human women. Okay? A bit of a corruption, if you will, of the genealogies. Okay, that's the preferred take here. Verse 3, and then we'll come back to this. In the middle of this whole discussion about kind of the corruption that's happening on the earth, God steps back and says, makes a statement. It's in quotes. We don't know who he's saying it to. But it says, my spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh, yet his days shall be 120 in 20 years. Now, this complications within complications, usually this has been taken to be one of two things. Either one, people's lifespan will be now limited, or number two, there's going to be 120 years before the flood. I think number two is preferred by most scholars. In other words, God is making this statement. There's going to be 120 years, and then I'm going to bring some change. I need to judge at that point in time. Back to this discussion about children of God, verse 4. It says there were giants, and that word is Nephilim. It's translated giants here, but that's not exactly what the word necessarily means. We're doing a bit of interpretation to come up with that. But it says there were giants on the earth in those days and afterward, when, again, the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. Interesting. No idea how that happens. Okay? We don't understand this. If this is the interpretation that's correct, how does an angelic being have a child with a human? We don't know. I think the only other example would be Jesus himself, right? The incarnation. So maybe there's some kind of twisted reference to that, driven by these nefarious angels. Nonetheless, they bore children to them. These were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. So again, their offspring were something unique and special. If these were simply humans having relations with others, we wouldn't expect kind of this anomalous outcome, these demigods who came out of it. But something was unique about these individuals, these offspring. And so they were famous people. They were the one who did the great exploits. I think Greek mythology of that nature, I'm assuming. So this word, giants. Nephilim, you guys hanging with me so far? Trying to? Nephilim, just grab on. Just grab on and hold. Okay, we'll get through it. Nephilim, this word is actually derived from a word meaning fall. In other words, the idea here is that they fall upon, they take vengeance, they act out on people, fall on them. Not necessarily that they're fallen angels, so probably more likely that they're attacking people. They're known for that, these men of renown, right? So not necessarily giants, but later in the Bible we see what are referred to as Nephilim, described as being extremely tall. And the children of Israel looking like grasshoppers next to them, okay? So that's where we're kind of pulling in this idea that they were big, they were giants. May or may not be the case at this point. Certainly later, the ones that were referred to as big Nephilim were. So, I think what we're seeing here, no matter what interpretation you are working off of, is kind of a stepping out of bounds of God's design. If these angelic beings were indeed taking human wives, the language here is very interesting how it's laid out. It says it like this. The sons of God saw the daughters of men. They saw them, that they were beautiful, right? That's what they saw in them. And they took wives. And this language, written by Moses, seems to really echo what happened in Genesis chapter 3, the fall. Remember Eve? She saw, she took. That's what's going on here, it appears. That this whole thing is showing that these guys were stepping out of bounds. They were doing something that was not proper. They were deviating from God's plan and directive. Okay? I'm going to move on. If you really want to talk about this stuff, we could chat later about the details there, but verse 5, continuing on. We're going to take a look at the culture at the time next, the culture. So this is all setting it up for the story of Noah, the one who escaped culture. Let's look at what the actual culture of the time was due to these pursuits outside of God's directive. Verse 5, God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that the intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. So people were focused on evil. It says that the intents of their hearts were on that. That doesn't mean that they believed it was. Perhaps the intents of their heart were, hey, I'm just trying to be a good person. I'm just reacting to the world around me. I, I'm not trying to hurt anybody. But from God's perspective that we see, the intent was only on evil continually. Their mind was warped in such a way that the focus of their life, their drive, their ambition was only for sinful activity. Left God out of the picture. So these violations, I think, were probably fundamentally violations of conscience for them. They didn't have God's written word. They didn't have preachers other than Enoch and Noah. But fundamentally, what they were doing is disobeying what they knew to be true, what they knew to be right in the most simple sense. Paul spoke about this in Romans 2. They demonstrate that God's law is written in their hearts. For their own conscience and thoughts either accuse them or tell them they are doing right. So even though they might not have church, as it were, or a Bible, as it were, God is still looking at this and holding an indictment against them, saying that they were doing things wrong. The intents of their heart and their minds were against God. They were simply doing their own thing. So what do we gather from this culture, kind of putting everything together that we've read so far? We see there's great violence. It says there's great wickedness. People's hearts and minds are focused on evil all the time. There were these perhaps demonically empowered celebrities. Everyone's choices were driven by lusts. But there was also culture. There was agriculture. There was business. There was music. There was manufacturing. The world was doing its thing. And later in Matthew 24, Jesus says that they were eating and drinking, marrying and given in marriage before the flood came. So I don't think we can look at this and think it was just total anarchy. That's not exactly right. It wasn't anarchy. In fact, it just seems a lot like our culture today, to be honest. A lot of people doing what they want to do, living out in culture, having long lives, being successful, ignoring God. And that's the culture in which we find ourselves in this story. God finds an indictment against these people. And here's his perspective. We rarely have insight here as to what God is feeling. We know what he's deducing and what he's doing. But here we actually know what he's feeling about all this. And what is God feeling? Let's go on. It says, "And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth. He was grieved in his heart. And the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing and birds of the air, for I am sorry. Sorry that I made them." So that's how he felt. Maybe a little different than we would initially think. Like, maybe he would be angry. Angry, but the primary emotion here is he's sorry. He's sad to see his creation in this state. This word is also translated regretted or even repented. Okay? That the Lord is grieved and he's repenting, if we could look at it that way. He's changing his heart and mind towards his creation. Now, he still loves them, and we're going to see he offers a way of salvation through this. But God can only react to what we do. Parents can only react to how their children make choices, right? There's only so much that God can do. He's extended his grace, favor, and instruction to these people before the flood. And their reaction is to say no thanks, to go their own way, to disobey their conscience and what they knew to be right. So it's interesting that if we could call it God's repentance, not that he's repenting from a sin or something that he did wrong, but a change in relation to what's happening, that his repentance brings about a result. He's not just changing his heart and mind, he's actually going to take action on the situation. And he's planning to bring destruction. The New Living Translation says the Lord was sorry he had ever put them on the earth. It broke his heart. It broke God's heart. It caused pain, emotional pain in God's heart. And I don't know if we oftentimes think of God the Father or the Godhead as having these kinds of emotions, especially when we get into discussions about sin and rebellion. Maybe we reserve that maybe more for Jesus oftentimes, the compassionate Jesus reaching out to people who are in need. But here we have pain in God's heart towards his creation who is in utter rebellion. But he has to react. He has to react to this creation that is headed in the wrong direction. The question may come up, well, why didn't God just fix it? If God is all-powerful, if God is all-knowing, why couldn't he fix this? Why couldn't he see it coming and correct? Or the classic question, if God was good and all-powerful, why does he allow such evil to exist? Well, the answer is, ultimately, he doesn't just allow it. He's not going to. That's kind of the point of this story, right? He's going to deal with it. He's going to deal with it in this story, and he will deal with it in the future in an ultimate sense. This is a bit of a preview, if you will. And others, people would look at God here in the story and say, well, he seems rather angry and violent to kill all these people. But look at what his heart is. Look at the emotion that we know about God in this case. It broke his heart. It grieved him that this had to be the way, that this is what became of his creation. And he is going to fix it. He is going to make things right. In small form, we're going to see that in the flood here. In future form, we're going to see that in the new heavens and the new earth. But he will fix it. He is able to fix. And it seems that God, throughout all these stories, is trying to show us that he doesn't need to do a hard reset. He didn't just completely destroy the world and start over. God is able to redeem. God is able to fix. No matter how bad things get. And that's what he's going to do through this story. He's going to offer a way through the difficulty. He's going to offer a way through. He's not just going to cut everybody off. He's going to offer a way through, and that's for Noah and his family. So verse 8, Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. That is, no, it says Noah found favor in some translations. Grace. This is God's, you could say, unmerited favor shown on Noah. It's not that Noah was not a godly person. I don't think we want to say that, because of what's stated next in the text, but it shows that God is having favor. God is choosing to show favor to this man, Noah, and not just him, his family. So verse 9, this is the genealogy of Noah. Noah was a just man, perfect in his generations. Noah walked with God, like Enoch. Noah begat three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. The earth also was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. So God looked on the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. And God said to Noah, "The end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them. And behold, I will destroy them with the earth. Make for yourself an ark of gopher wood. Make rooms in the ark and cover it inside and outside with pitch. This is how you shall make it. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, its width 50 cubits, and its height 30 cubits. You shall make a window for the ark, and you shall finish it to a cubit from above and set the door of the ark in its side. You shall make it with lower, second, and third decks." Not to get into this too deep, but I think it's clear that God had a very specific way that he wanted this built. Knowing what God was going to do, the destruction that he was going to bring led God to give Noah specifics about how he was to survive. And maybe we can address this in future discussions as far as the dimensions of the ark and so forth. But suffice it to say, this is about a third of the size of the Titanic. This is big. And I know some of you guys have went to visit the remake down in, where is it, Kentucky, and been wowed by that. But this is a huge ship, a huge undertaking that Noah was given as a task. Verse 17, "Behold, I am bringing floodwaters on the earth to destroy from under heaven all flesh, in which is the breath of life. Everything on the earth shall die." So we see God at this point in time, he's going to scale back creation. If you look at the days and what was created on those days, he's basically taking the last few days and scaling that back. He's destroying man. He's destroying birds. And he's destroying everything that was walking around on the ground, all your cats and dogs. He's going to take those things out. He doesn't take out the fish. He doesn't destroy the earth. But he does scale back creation. That's his plan, to scale it back. I want you to think about all the people that were on earth at this point in time, just the population itself. We don't know what that is, but there's been some estimations. And those estimations, kind of based on current population growth, maybe put the population around 750 million as a low end. But if you think about how people seem to live long lives and have many sons and daughters, if we just bump up that scaling a little bit, they figure there might be billions, a few billion people on the earth at this point in time. That's a lot of people going astray. And just a few, eight, that seem to care for God at all. Jesus would say later in Matthew 7, "Enter by the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the way that leads to destruction. And there are many who go by it. Because narrow is the gate, and difficult is the way that leads to life. And there are few who find it." And this is where we find Noah. He's in that narrow space, God's will, serving God, finding favor in his sight, having God's grace on his life. Whereas the vast majority of this world is headed for destruction at this point in time. Verse 18, "I will establish my covenant with you." So he has favor. And God said he's going to establish a covenant, an agreement, a blessing. He's going to save his family. And then after the flood, we're going to see the ratification of that covenant, the rainbow in the sky. And God's going to make some promises to his creation that he would never destroy it in such a way again. But with the responsibility that Noah has also comes the blessing of standing in God's covenant. Standing in God's covenant. That we, like Noah, if we stand in his covenant and grace, can obtain the promises of God, the salvation of God. Now, what I want to do for the last few minutes today is look at this very last verse. We're going to skip down to verse 22 of chapter 6. And it says this, "Thus Noah did according to all that God commanded him, so he did." I just want to look at a few points and hopefully find some application for us in this verse. Number one, Noah's faith became physical. Noah's faith became physical. Hebrews 11, verse 1 says that faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not yet seen. It's the substance, it's the stuff. Faith is the practical manifestation of a belief. And if we see nothing else in the life of Noah, we see that in his building of the ark. We see action. Verse 14, God tells him, "Make yourself an ark. Make rooms in the ark. Cover it." inside and out with pitch. For Noah to believe, for Noah to have faith, meant that Noah did. He got his hands dirty. He got in there and got to work. If Noah obeyed, there was going to be life and flourishing. If he obeyed. What if he didn't? What if Noah didn't get busy about building the ark? Well, now we're talking predestination and all that. Okay. What if he didn't? Plain and simply, this wasn't going to work out. But God told him to do, and Noah, by faith, got busy. He got busy according to what God said. Not what God didn't say, but according to what God said. And I want you to notice that God wasn't simply going to spiritually, quote-unquote, protect his people here. He wasn't just going to, you know, wave a magic wand over the situation to save Noah. Noah had to get his hands dirty and put a hammer to nails to build this ark. Philippians chapter 2, verses 12 and 13 say, "Therefore, my beloved, as much as you have always obeyed, not in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling." Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who works in you both to will and to do his good pleasure. This was Noah. He's working out God's plan for his life. And it gets really physical. Like, he had to collect this stuff. He had to cut down trees. He had to learn how to woodwork. He had to collect pitch. He had to put his sons to work. He had to manage the situation. He had to collect food for himself and all the animals. He had to get stuff together. He had to create a plan and get to work to obey God. I think the basic idea is that Noah worked God's plan. He heard from God and responded by working. Now, I don't mean at all to mix this into saying he somehow worked for his salvation. We know that from Ephesians 2, that it's by grace we are saved through faith. But what I'm saying is, if Noah didn't do anything, this isn't going to work out. If he didn't demonstrate his faith by obeying, there's going to be problems. Not just for him, but for his family and all future generations. So Noah got busy. His faith became physical. Number two, real quick, Noah cared about the details. You notice all the details? Make it this wide, three floors, this tall. Covered inside and outside with pitch. God was very specific because he knew what was coming at a future date. And he wanted Noah to be prepared for it. So God delivered details to Noah, and Noah obeyed details. He had to hear, maybe he had to write this stuff down, then he had to figure out how to obey the details. Now, perhaps he had massive motivation to do that, right? Knowing what was coming, like, I want to survive this. Shouldn't we have the same attitude? If God knows what's coming and he gives us specific details on how to live our lives, shouldn't we approach it with the same attitude? Are you a person who tends to just gloss over the details? Just kind of generally follow God, drifting here and there from location to location, church to church? I don't know. Or are you listening? And are you willing to obey the details that God has for you? Third, what was Noah's attitude during his time? An interesting question. We don't really know from this passage, but we do know from the New Testament. Hebrews 11:7. What was Noah's attitude? Hebrews 11:7, by faith, being divinely warned of things not yet seen, moved with godly fear. Noah had godly fear. That was the apparently primary emotion in Noah's life. Fear of God. Not fear of destruction, but fear of God, who could bring it. Godly fear. It led him to diligently stick to the plan. It wasn't fun and games for Noah. He wasn't making choices about what this ark should look like, if he should maybe add another door here, another window here. Godly fear led him to stick to the plan, to follow the details, and to build this ark, to obey the way God wanted him to. I wonder what emotions generally tend to describe our attitude as we live out this life. Is godly fear in the mix, even? Fear of God, obedience to what he's delivered to us. And lastly, Noah was ready, plain and simple. Noah was ready when the time came. Not just ready to obey, but diligent to finish it when the time came for the flood. How long did he have to build the ark? If you were Noah, did you know how long he had? Apparently not. We don't really have God telling him how long he's got to build the ark. 2 months? 10 years? 80 years? We don't know. So how do you plan for that? I think he just got busy. He just tried to be obedient. He made plans to complete the ark, because if that's what God told him to do, apparently it's possible. And this probably took him the better part of a century to finish this thing out. We're not certain, but a lot of years. And it's interesting, if you read in the next chapter, when did he finish the ark? Or when did God bring the flood? 7 days after he finished it? Something like that? I think the point is this. We might not know the timing of everything God has for us, but I bet you most of us know the task. I bet you most of us know what we're supposed to be doing. And if you don't, I think you can find out pretty quick if you're honest. Do you know what you're supposed to be doing? What is your task? What has God delivered to you? Perhaps generally in his word. Perhaps specifically for you. Are you getting busy with that? Or have you relegated that? We'll get to it someday. I've got plenty of time before judgment, before I don't have a chance anymore. What's your task? What's your task? Are you diligent to it? Are you thinking through the details? Are you digging into God's word to find out what it takes to complete that task? Because, listen, culture, just like at this time, it's not going anywhere. All this is going to come to an end. There's going to be a new heaven and a new earth. This culture that we strive so much to succeed in, to make our way in, to find ourselves in, to make something out of ourselves in, that's going nowhere. It's going to be destroyed, just like in the flood. But will you find God's task for you? Will you plug in and commit to the details? Because I'll tell you what, this took Noah's whole life to do this. It's going to take your whole life to be a disciple. It's going to take everything you got. It's going to take godly fear. It's going to take attention to the details. 1 Corinthians 3, starting in verse 11. Here's to wrap things up. No other foundation can anyone lay except that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now, if anyone builds on this foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, or straw, each one's work will become clear. For the day will declare it. That's judgment day. Because it will be revealed by fire. And the fire will test each one's work, what sort it is. If anyone's work, which he has built, endures, he will receive a reward. If anyone's work is burned, he will suffer loss. But he himself will be saved, yet so through fire. Noah's work endured. It made it through the flood. Because he did it God's way. Will yours? Will yours? And I don't mean to mix this in with salvation, guys. But if you are saved, you're going to do this. You're going to obey God. You're going to have a heart for God's will or word. You're going to put your hand to the plow. I'm not saying you're going to be perfect. I'm not saying you're going to do everything right. But you will care about the details. You will have a godly fear. You will follow. Are you doing so?